We're in 2 Corinthians 8 through 11 this evening. Last week we looked at the benediction. We used the word benediction because it starts with a blessing. We usually think of benediction as what we close a service with. But as we mentioned last week, there are only two of Paul's letters that start with this idea of blessing. He starts in Ephesians and here in 2 Corinthians with the idea of blessing. Everything else starts with a thanksgiving, except for Galatians, which has neither. But as we move into 8 to 11, last week the overall thing was that God comforts us in our afflictions. God comforts us, and by being comforted, we are in a position to comfort those that are afflicted. And that's where he goes last week. Well, this week he moves in, and there's a shift that takes place as he starts to talk about a specific affliction. And so while in great despair, according to this passage, we could deduce that while in great despair, one can learn to trust in God even more, and this should create prayers of thanksgiving by others. In verse 8, we might summarize it saying that Paul shares a new perspective on his recent afflictions. It begins with the word for, at least. I didn't look at the NIV. If the NIV begins with four, I think it does also, doesn't it? Verse 8, anybody have NIV? I'm sorry, 2 Corinthians 1, verse 8. 2 Corinthians 1, verse 8. Well, I'm not going to sit on the second row unless you make a second row. 2 Corinthians 1, 8. So he says, for we do not want you to be unaware, brethren. The word for is an explanatory bridge from the opening benediction to this section. And it moves us from this general reference about afflictions to a specific reference of Paul's affliction, in Asia that he's going to refer. So it moves from the general concept of afflictions to one singular affliction. He says, unaware. I do not want you to be unaware, brethren. This word for unaware could be in the sense of not to know, to be ignorant. And that may be the aspect here. It's also used later in 2 Corinthians, in the sense of not to know. But here it may indicate not so much new information, though it could be, like he's about to give new information. I don't want you to be unaware. I'm going to give you new information. But maybe here he's saying, I'm going to give you a new perspective. So it may not be that they're unaware of this event that took place. They may know about it, but he's going to give a perspective on it, a theological perspective on it. But he says, I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, of our affliction. If you have the NIV, I believe you'll have troubles. And so it would be very similar to what he said earlier when he's saying about all these afflictions or troubles. But here it really is not plural. It's a singular, and the NIV gives us that idea that he's talking about a bunch of them. And I think it would be better that he's talking about a single event, though that obviously a single event could have multiple aspects to it, I guess. But he says that we don't want you to be unaware, brethren, of our affliction which came to us in Asia. Affliction, as we looked last week, that, it has a range of meaning, but as we're saying here, it's this, he's looking at a specific one. And he's choosing to focus on the theological importance rather than the physical details. So as we get looking at it, he never tells us specifically what it was. We can make the assumption that the Corinthians knew, or that maybe whoever delivered the letter, they were able to ask him, and they knew that way. But Paul doesn't focus on what the affliction was, those details, because he's moving in this theological connection. But the word affliction, while it was rare in extra-biblical Greek, there it had this literal meaning of pressure, pressing down, a pressure. And then it came in the, in the Bible in the sense of oppression or affliction or tribulation. It could be in the sense of distress that's brought about by outward circumstances, and that would be the idea here. In 2 chapter 2 and verse 4, we'll see it as perhaps in the sense of a spiritual affliction. That here, as we talked last week, saying that, it's looking at these difficult outward circumstances And the context here is not just any outward circumstances, not so broad in the sense of trials, but more specifically looking at those things that come about by ministry. You know, pressures, afflictions, troubles that come because one's in ministry. And we shouldn't think of that ministry, you know, being like, well, you had to be Paul or you have to be a pastor. Anybody involved in any kind of ministry that you know, witnesses somebody or doing something, that there might be affliction that comes, hostility that comes. And here, you know, it probably should be inclusive of the external and internal distress that's caused. So it may start with that external, the outward circumstance, but it brings about that internal distress that Paul's talking about. So he says, I don't want you to be uninformed, brethren, of our affliction, which came to us in Asia. Well, we know where it came, but specifically what, we don't know. It may be one of these that, along the line where Paul, irritated some people because he cast out a demon, and there are right results because, you know, comes from that, because now their money making scheme is out. And but that one, it seems to be, you know, a stop put to it. So you can speculate on several kinds of things. Maybe he was thrown in jail and we don't have the account. You could just go on and come up with stuff. But the fact is, we do not know what he's talking about. But it was serious. And that's interesting in itself. You think about how many things there are in the book of Acts that we know of the situations and how distressful they must have been. I mean, he's let down in a basket to escape a city because they're going to kill him. He tells us that he was flogged, three times with 39 lashes. And yet, those may not be all of them. It may not be a summary of them. Though he does kind of perhaps gives a summary, and we'll see later in 2 Corinthians where he goes through kind of a list. But whatever this deal was, it was very stressful. He goes on to say that he was burdened with it. He says here that we were burdened excessively beyond our strength. That's kind of piling up words there to communicate something. Burdened, that would be enough by itself. Excessively, beyond our strength. I mean, you got two, you know, kind of approaches there. The burden is used three times in Paul, four or five times in the Gospels. It can mean that sense of the weigh down. It's used figuratively of like heavy eyelids. Here it's in that sense of being burdened altogether beyond one's strength. In 1 Timothy 5:16, it says the church is not to be burdened. Later in 2 Corinthians here, he talks about 5:4, says, for indeed while we were in this tent, we groaned being burdened. So when he's talking about our physical bodies before the resurrection, he even talks about a natural sense of being burdened by the living in a fallen world with this body as opposed to the resurrection. Then he says, burdened excessively. Something that's beyond measure, beyond proportion. And then he says that it's beyond our strength. The word strength there is the word, for ability or capability. So it's, he's looking at it, this is beyond what we're able to deal with. So this is a really strong one, especially when you compare it to something where it says God does not tempt us beyond what we're able. Well, he's saying here, we're being pushed right to the limit. And if that's not strong enough, he goes on, he says, so that with the result we despised even of life, or despaired even of life. Despaired means to be in great difficulty, doubt, or embarrassment. Here it's in the sense of despair of living. Later he'll use it in 4:8, he'll say we're perplexed, but not despairing. I used to read this and think this was kind of figurative language. Paul was exaggerating to make a point, because it just seemed like, not Paul. These guys, they never got to the point of being in despair of their life. They were never that way. And that's just reading hopeful theology into something that's not there. And it causes us to have a bad theology when we do that. As opposed to seeing what he's really saying. He's saying, yeah, this was a situation that really got him down. I mean, it was tough. He was burdened excessively. It was beyond what he was able to deal with. He's saying, caused him even in the sense of despairing even of life. You know, I think we don't give enough, or I haven't, you know, in years past, I, you know, when I read that, just kind of dismissing it, it really doesn't equip you to deal with life. Now, as we mentioned last week, this passage, or all of 2 Corinthians, as we'll see, is really talking about things related to ministry. I mean, the pressures he's talking about, it's talking about being for ministry. And unfortunately, here, it's not primarily from those outside the church. Within this book, it's mainly people within that's causing all this. But here he is, he's saying, whatever this event was in Asia, which wasn't necessarily within the church, he's saying, man, it was great. And this is part of why people were criticizing Paul. This is part of the attack. Saying, look at what happened to you. You know, if that happened to you, then obviously God's blessing is not upon you. That type of thing. And so here he's saying, man, this was a tough time. But he moves on from that. And in verse 9, we might say, there was a theological significance to the affliction. To trust God, not self. So we see in 9, he says, indeed, we had the sentence of death within ourselves, so that we would not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead. The word indeed is a very good English translation. However, the word behind this translation is a contrastive word, which is often translated as but in our text. And it's what it's looking at. If you look at the end of verse 8, we have the word life, and then here in verse 9, it's the sentence of death. And those are being contrasted there. And so, indeed is, you know, the good translation, the proper translation, but we miss that contrast by that translation in English. He's saying, you know, here, you know, we despaired of life, but we had the sentence of death. And so it's that life and death there. We have, in the New American Standard, it says we had. NIV says we felt. This is a perfect tense. And the thing about the perfect is it's past tense, but it looks at continuing action. So when he's saying this, we had this... we had this sentence of death within us, or we felt, if you have the NIV, felt this sentence of death. Well, it's not, you know, I can look back and say, man, you know, I remember when that happened. I felt that back then. I can kind of remember it. It was a long time. I felt all of that. But he's not saying that. He said, I felt it, and I still feel it. It's continuing results. So this, whatever this was, had a significance, such a significance that there's a sense that Paul is saying, it still's with me. You know, the impact of it is still with me. He says the sentence of death, perhaps we're to see this figuratively in the sense of, you know, he felt like a condemned man awaiting execution. Because there's nothing to point to that there's really some judicial sense of death, because that wasn't the typical thing when they were in prison. And we don't know of any of that. So I think here that Paul is not referring to that he actually had a sentence of death, but it's in the sense of his emotions, what he felt, and how it was impacting him. It says, so that here, we had this earlier, it says, indeed, we had the sentence of death within ourselves, so that, and here it's in that sense of a purpose, so that. There was a divine purpose here. We would not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead. And you notice there's a positive negative, starts with a negative, so that we would not trust in ourselves. We see that tendency that we all have to trust in ourselves. Even as believers that believe in God, believe in prayer, there is that tendency at times that we go to God in prayer when things are really difficult, when we've exhausted all possibilities, when we don't know where else to go, then we go to God. And so I don't know that we can read into this and saying that Paul was trusting in himself in any of this, but the situation was such that, you know, here we have an apostle and all the things that Paul's been through, and yet he's learning another level, another measure of trusting God. And that's not our typical picture. For whatever reason, we elevate these guys, because, I mean, Paul, you know, you start reading in Acts, I mean, this guy is up there quite a ways in his confidence in God, his, you know, things, and yet he's saying here, hey, I learned another level. And, you know, maybe that's something for us to think about. And, you know, when situations come, I mean, there is that sense that we read James and we say, when your trials come, you know, God's going to perfect our character. And we kind of have that there. But I don't know that we have it so ingrained in our mind to think of, well, you know, if Paul could move to another level of trusting God, you know, maybe that's where I need to be, where I need to be evaluating this thing, is that, you know, I can take a step up. I can move one more stair up in my ability to trust God. And so he says here that there's a divine purpose through this, that we would not trust in ourselves but in God. And then notice that, and we think about trust, the trust here is a perfect participle. So we talked about the perfect while ago, having that sense of continuing action. And so here it's emphasizing that there's a confidence in this continuing sense of trust. So there may be that sense that whatever it was that occurred is continually impacting him, but also the trust that he learned is continuing with him. And he says, in God who raises the dead, that we would not trust in ourselves, but our trust would be God who raises the dead. Well, you think about that. If you're in a situation, an impossible situation, and you're looking for deliverance, what is the greatest display of deliverance there can be? God raises the dead. And what's intriguing with this passage is that a couple of things. Well, the word first is a present active participle, raises, so it's emphasizing that this is a present power of God. He raises the dead. So it's not that raising the dead was, you know, once or twice thing with God. This is who he is. This is what he typically does. However, when we look in Scripture, there's 11 passages that speak of God, that God raised Christ. You know, some form, it says in Acts 3:15, but put to death the Prince of Life, the one whom God raised from the dead. Acts 4:11. Let it be known to all of you and to all the people of Israel that by the name of Jesus Christ the Nazarene, whom you crucified, whom God raised from the dead. Acts 13:30. But God raised him from the dead. Anyway, it goes on. We have these. It's God raised him from the dead. 1 Peter 1:21. Who through him are believers in God who raised him from the dead. The focus in all of these, when you do a word search on, you know, God and raised in the New Testament, is that God raised a point in time Jesus from the dead. Hebrews 11:19, however, in going back to Abraham, it says, he considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead. And so when Abraham was looking at this, you know, Isaac and going to sacrifice, he looked at God and said, God is one who has the ability to raise even from the dead. And Colossians says that we've been buried with Christ in baptism, in which you were also raised with him. So we have that association that we were raised with Christ. But what Paul is saying here is much closer to what Abraham was saying. This is who God is. He's not looking at a point in history and saying, God raised Christ. This is who God is. That God is a God who raises the dead. This is who he is. And so Paul's confidence in God in this deliverance sense is that God is the God who raises presently. That's his quality. That's his character. It's not a once or twice kind of thing. This is who he is. Well, verse 10, it's, we have set our hope on this delivering God, he says. We've set our hope on this delivering God. He says, who God raised us from the dead. And in this, you know, hope that'll come at the end of the passage, he says, we have set our hope at the end of verse 10. Hope's that certain confidence in God. That certain confidence. And it's here he says, set our hope. It's used in, set our hope is used in this passage. It's also used in Hebrews 6:18. It says, so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we have taken refuge, would have strong encouragement to take hold of the hope set before us. But most often, we have it five times in Scripture, or in the New Testament, it's fix our hope. 1 Timothy 4:10, for it is for this we labor and strive, because we have fixed our hope on the living God, who is the Savior of all men, especially of believers. 1 Timothy, so three of them are in 1 Timothy, interesting. 1 Timothy 5:5, now she who is a widow indeed, and who has been left alone, has fixed her hope on God. And then we have a kind of a different angle, a different look at it in 1 Timothy 6:17. It says, instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies. 1 Peter 1:13, therefore prepare your minds for action. Keep sober in spirit. Fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And 1 John 3:3, and everyone who has this hope fixed, and the fixed is actually not a, it's supplied, it wasn't, you know, from the context. Fixed his hope on him, purifies himself just as pure. But here the hope is a similar term, just not the same word, but it's, you know, that fixed our hope, set our hope. What is our focus? And I think the Peter or the Timothy 6:17 is a great one talking about rich. You know, encourage them not to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches. Well, take out the riches and just put anything you want to in. The uncertainty of what? Because everything is uncertain except God. But we do put our hope in other things. You know, hopes in the stock market, the hopes in who's going to be president, the hopes in, you know, this bill is going to pass, the hopes in, you know, whatever. We tend to get that way from time to time. And he's saying, here, you know, fix, set our hope on God. There are three actions in this passage. And it moves from a past deliverance to a immediate future deliverance to the ultimate future deliverance. It says, who delivered us, so we're in the past, who delivered us from so great a peril of death. So he's going back to this, you know, how he saw this situation as a peril of death. And will deliver us. He on whom we have set our hope, and he will yet deliver us. So Paul, I believe, is looking at, he looks in the immediate past of the physical life. He has delivered us, and he will deliver us sometime in the future. But also, ultimately, he's going to deliver us. You know, that's really a different perspective from just having that sense of eternal life. You know, that hope in God that's eternal. You know, that when I die, I'll go to heaven. Here he's saying, you know, God has provided for me. God will provide for me. God will greatly provide for me in that future sense. And then he ends this with thanksgivings are the proper response to God's deliverance of yourself and of others. He says in verse 11, you also join in helping us through your prayers, so that thanks may be given by many persons on our behalf for the favor bestowed on us through the prayers of many. Paul says something similar in chapter 4 and verse 15. He says, for all things are for your sakes, so that the grace which is spreading to more and more people may cause the giving of thanks to abound to the glory of God. And then in chapter 9, he again says something similar in verse 11. He says, you will be enriched in everything for all liberality, which through us is producing thanksgiving to God. For the ministry of this service is not only fully supplying the needs of the saints, but it's also overflowing through many thanksgiving to God. So he sees this as, you know, when you participate by praying for someone and they're delivered, the response is, now I thank God for this deliverance. And so it's interesting that Paul ends up that his ultimate concern is not about his rescue from danger, but that God will be honored more and more. It's clear here that he believes in prayer, believes in a God of grace that listens and provides. And so he had a very, very difficult situation, one that was overwhelming almost, but God delivered him in it. And the result of that deliverance was he has a greater faith in God, but also the proper result of that deliverance is not only that his faith is increased, but that others should be aware and praising God for it. Well, do you have any thoughts or questions or insights on this section?
You know, all this about trouble.
Yeah.
We're going to be in them. We're going to have to deal with them. And then it's almost like, it just seems so much like a red. It's like, this is what's recently happened. This is on my mind. Let me tell you, you already know this, but I'm here to tell you, this is a ministry of Christ. This is a ministry of God. Got troubles.
And it's even more so if you think about it, that, as we'll see, that he's being criticized. I think that's a lot of it. Being criticized by some of these, his authority's being challenged because he had these troubles. So it's like, so it's also in the sense of, through these afflictions, God has comforted me, which allows me to comfort you in your afflictions. It's this real divine perspective.
Well, it's only, and it just flies in the face of this prosperity idea for our lives. Not just about the money aspect of the ministry, but just this whole idea that that's what it's going to do, doing well, so to speak, behaving, et cetera, et cetera. That there's this one ray of light.
Makes you wonder how it stays around,
yeah.
And it's been around forever. And I mean, we see it in places in the New Testament. There's a sense it's been around forever. I think there is a part of that teaching that we probably miss out on, not emphasizing enough of God's provision and some of those kinds of things, and we may miss on that. And that may be why it gives it a window. But on the other hand, you have to wonder, it's like, what do they do when they come to a passage like this? You have to end up explaining it away. You can't really embrace it because that's what they're saying. So I don't know. It's really, really bizarre. And I think what you end up with, and I've heard, because I'm not really, don't really read a lot about it, and never been a part of a church like that, but from some things I've heard, I think what you end up with at times, at least, is that you have to dismiss people. Something's wrong with them. Look at what's going on. You push them out. And if you think about it, that to some degree is what Paul is dealing with. These people are saying, you really don't have this authority because, look what happened. You got thrown in jail. You got beat up. Yes,
so,
but not what happened in Asia, but
right.
But yeah.
The criticism because of that, you must not be God's man, or you will be going through this kind of thing. That's coming from the Corinthians.
Well, let me put it that I'm reading into it, and I think others are reading it. We know he's being criticized, so when you see him writing like this, I think we're reading into it that's probably part of the criticism.
So if he just goes straight to verse 8. If I am being critical of him, and he immediately goes into that, I'm already thinking as I'm reading that scene.
Yeah.
But with 4 through 7, it's like, it makes me feel bad for
Yeah, because he's saying there's a value.
Yeah.
You know, it's a value for you.
Changing the canvas.
Yes.
By those three verses.
Yeah. And even verse 11 becomes, you know, now this is the opportunity for you to thank God. You know, it's one thing to say when somebody says, I'm crediting God for this in my life. And you're kind of like, okay, do what you want to. But when then they say, and your proper response should be to thank God. So, and there's also, you know, he says, you also joining and helping us through your prayers. So, and you know, somebody may want to read in that and say, well, he's kind of being a little sarcastic because they weren't praying for him. But that's not to say everybody at Corinth was against him. That wasn't true. And people have responded positively. We were talking last week, granted, there's a letter that we'll see later referred here as the sorrowful letter. And everything indicates this is a lost letter. You know, we do not have it. So if we were numbering these, you know, this is actually 3 Corinthians. We don't have 2 Corinthians. But everything here, huh?
I thought this was 4.
You may.
Was 2. Sorrow was
3. Oh, you mean as far as order?
Yeah. 1 Corinthians was the 2nd.
I don't think so, but could be right. But the he is, you know, they've responded to that. But there's still some that are agitators. Anything else? What are their prayer requests?